Your argument next in case 14-15-13, Halo Electronics versus Pulse Electronics, and consolidated case 14-15-20, Stryker Corporation versus Zimmer. Mr. Wall?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the Federal Circuit has developed such a rigid test for enhanced damages in patent infringement cases that a large number of the worst infringers, even bad faith copiers, are immunized from any enhancement. The Federal Circuit has done that by moving away from historical practice in two key ways. First, it's made the test all about recklessness rather than also intent. Second, it judges recklessness based on legal defenses developed in litigation rather than the facts at the time of the infringement. The net result, now that this Court in Octane and Highmark set aside a similarly artificial test for fees, is a one-of-its-kind, good-for-patent-damages-only framework that does not track the enhancement statute's text, history, or purposes. It was not always this way. For nearly 150 years, district courts conducted a totality inquiry subject to deferential review, and as part of that, they said the nature of the infringement has to be more than negligent if it's going to be an aggravating factor that counsels in favor of an enhancement.
Is that what you're advocating, to return to that? Just it's a matter of discretion for the district court, and that's it.
In a word, yes. We do think that there are principles to guide district court's discretion, because historically district courts said certain things, but the one agreed-upon principle, I think, you know, we all agree on it, or at least petitioners in the PTO do, is the court said in the totality, if the patentee wants to point to the nature of the infringement and say that pulls you out of the mine run of cases and that warrants an enhancement, it had to be more than negligent. It had to be intentional or reckless infringement. But based on the facts of the time, it was a traditional willfulness inquiry. It was not the willfulness inquiry that the Federal Circuit conducts, which looks at after-the-fact defenses and not what were the facts facing the infringer at the time of its
misconduct. You referred to the nature of the infringement. Is that the only thing that's involved here? Are any of the petitioners asking for enhanced damages based on litigation misconduct, for example?
Well, I think there was some litigation misconduct here, and we cite it, and it's in the district court's opinion, that Zimmer did conceal some things in the run-up to trial. So I do think there were some other factors, but I think the major one here, for instance, in Stryker, was the nature of the infringement, that they hired an independent contractor, they handed the contractor a patented product, they said essentially make one of these for us.
So do we have to decide whether enhanced damages can be awarded solely based on litigation misconduct? That would seem to be a separate question. You say that the main thing involved is the nature of the infringement. So what is the issue before us?
Yeah, I don't want to say that you have to, and I want to be careful about litigation misconduct, because in a number of the older cases, it was something like concealment, which was post-infringement but pre-litigation, so it was a broader category of misconduct. But no, I think the only reason that we and the PTO have pointed to the compensation cases and the misconduct cases is just to show that for 150 years, it was a totality inquiry and district courts were looking at a lot of different things. These cases are primarily about the nature of the infringement. Most cases will be like that. I think if the court wanted to provide guidance to the Federal Circuit about how to run this statute, it should say, go back to doing a totality inquiry, and here's some of the principles that historically guided your exercise of discretion. But I don't think you have to do that, Justice Alito. I think you could more narrowly.
Why is the nature of the infringement so determinative under your view? Yes, they copied it, but perhaps they had, you know, a good faith belief that this wasn't patented. So the fact that they copied it doesn't seem to me to automatically make it something which is suitable for sanctions.
So the products here were marked. I mean, they were marked as patented. But I take your point, Mr. Chief Justice, and I think
— Or they could have had, you know, a good faith belief that the patent wasn't valid.
Sure. And that's exactly historically how the case has played out, and it's how they should play out once this court takes care of Seagate, which is both parties come in at the enhancement stage. Most of the evidence has come in on infringement for liability or damages. And the patentee will say, you copied a patented product and haven't shown any evidence that you had a reasonable belief in invalidity. And the defendant, if the patentee has carried its burden, will say, no, I did some investigation. I thought I wasn't infringing, or I thought it was invalid. And the district court will make a judgment call faced with those competing narratives about what the right answer is based on the facts. Our point is that that judgment call that district courts are making for a very long time has essentially been stripped from them, because it no longer matters. Even if you acted intentionally at the time, as Zimmer did, What the Federal Circuit says is, if you can hire good lawyers and come up with defenses in litigation, you'll be off the hook. And as Justice Breyer pointed out in the Octane litigation, and I now know it's true from preparing for this case, you can — a patent lawyer can virtually always come up with some non-frivolous defense in litigation, and that's why, in effect, what you have is almost a per se bar.
That may be, but this is my question on this. The statute doesn't say anything. The statute just says, in either event, the court may increase the damages up to 3 times the amount found or assessed. I don't get too much guidance from that. Let me assume against you, that the history does not favor you. The history insists upon willful. Let me assume with you that there isn't good ground for clear and convincing. Nothing suggests that. But now the hardest part for me, and it is hard, I don't have a clear answer, is there are indeed some preliminary intests. If, for example, the patentee has a flaw in his patent, not enough to kill it, but enough to make it pretty uncertain. A weak patent, there are all kinds of things wrong with it. No willfulness damages, irrespective almost of the state of mind of the infringer. You say, well, what could be said for that? You've read their excellent briefs on both sides, and you know perfectly well what can be said for that. And if I summarize it, and that's what I want your answer to, today's patent world is not a steam engine world. We have decided to patent tens of thousands of software products and similar things where hardly anyone knows what the patent's really about. A company that's a startup, a small company, once it gets a letter, cannot afford to pay $10,000 to $100,000 for a letter from counsel and may be willing to run its chances. You start saying, little company, you must pay $10,000 to $100,000 to get a letter, lest you get willful damages against you should your bet be wrong. We have one more path leading us to national monopoly by Google and Yahoo or their equivalents. And the patent statute is not designed to create monopolies throughout the United States. It's designed to help the small businessman, not to hurt him. So leave those words for interpretation to the expert court. And in this area, it may well be the Federal Circuit. Have I stated the argument pretty much the way it is? Or if I have, I would like your response to it.
I think you have stated the best possible version of respondent's argument. I'm happy with your assumptions. The PTO embraces them, and we are not living in a steam engine world. It's a high bar to carry, and I don't think patentees are often going to be able to do it. And what you rightly said, I think that is what respondents have — that's been their strategy in this court.
It's not just their strategy. We have all kinds of amicus briefs that say that's the truth. And indeed, thousands and thousands and thousands of small businessmen are trying to break into businesses that they just can't do without software. And when you have tens or hundreds of thousands of patents on software by other companies, that means we can't break in.
Justice Breyer, the sky didn't fall for a century and a half, and it's not going to fall if you reverse the Federal Circuit's framework, just as it didn't fall after Octane and Highmark in the fees context. You've got to show as a patentee,
It hasn't fallen. Go look at the market shares of the different companies that are seriously involved in
software. Justice Breyer, showing intent or recklessness based on the facts of the time is not going to be easy. The intent box is copying patented products, and I don't think we have a lot of dispute that where people are copying patented products in the absence of a reasonable belief in invalidity, it doesn't matter whether they're making software.
Then are you satisfied with this? You've just used a word that might help. Reasonable belief. We say that where a company is small, where it is small, and wants to run the risk, follow the Fed Circuit rule. In order to show willfulness, because it's reasonable, You have to show that that infringer not only didn't know it was faulty, but also was a big company that was pretty used to getting these lawyers' opinions and also pretty used to asking their own experts whether it really was a good patent or not, and they didn't do it here. What about something like
that? Justice Breyer, we tried in our opening brief to embrace the full totality of circumstances, including the strength of the patent, the kind of notice, what's commercially reasonable in the industry. The one point I just want to make, because I think it's very important, is to get into the recklessness box at common law and traditionally, you had to show an objectively high risk. So as a patentee, you've got to show to the judge not just that infringement occurred, but that a reasonable person looking at it would have said, there is a very high risk that what I am doing is unlawful because it trenches on someone else's valid patent. That's a pretty high bar. You're not going to be able to satisfy that. You shouldn't be able to satisfy that in a lot of cases. I think the strength of the PTO's argument is when you can show that, the district court should be able to make a judgment call about enhancement, and the fact that it can't shows you that you've really skewed the incentives, because on the other side of the parade of horribles you're worried about are the people who can infringe, knowing that they can discount by the probability that they'll be found to have infringed in litigation with virtually no back-end penalty, even if they were a very bad infringer, as Zimmer was here.
Tell me how you articulate this. And I ask because the SG is talking about describing it as egregious conduct. You're saying something about willfulness and recklessness. I don't know if this is all a matter of semantics, but I think the SG is right. Even if you give discretion to the district courts to make a judgment of when to enhance penalties, we have to give them some guidance.
Yes.
It can't be that they can give enhanced penalties on whim.
That's right.
All right? So if it's not whim, what is it? How do we articulate a test that protects what Justice Breyer is concerned about, which I think is a
yes.
legitimate concern, but doesn't entrench a position that just favors you?
No,
and by that I mean, you know,
No, I think there's a little bit of daylight between us and the government in the sense that we think the statute was invoked for various purposes and not just to punish infringement. But to the extent that you invoke the statute to punish infringement, I think there is no daylight between our position and the government's.
So how do
and I think what the opinion would say to give the guidance is, in the lion's share of cases, what the parties are really debating is the nature of the infringement. That needs to be intentional or reckless based on the facts as they were known to the infringer. And as part of whether the infringer
is acting. The retest understands life a little is more
sure.
complex than that, okay? Because you can often use the conduct of someone after the time to reflect what they thought. And so if you're seeing that someone is withholding information, you might be able to infer that there wasn't good faith at the beginning.
Sure.
So your articulation doesn't really give life to the complexity of this inquiry.
So, and to add then a little more, I think what you ought to be taking into account is, for instance, the strength of the notice. Some of these letters are just form letters. They really are nothing more than a license.
This is all the Reed Corporation factors that the district court here did in the Stryker case.
I think that's right. I think some of them will matter more than others, but some claim letters are very fulsome.
Well,
they have a claim
charge.
That's
very nice, but if I don't want to adopt that test, how do I articulate this in a more generalized way?
I think what you would say is that in judging whether a reasonable person would have thought that there was a really high risk, you've got to take account of both the strength of the notice, what kind of notice were they on of the patent, and what would have been commercially reasonable in the industry as it exists. And I think that those factors and those limitations are going to take account of the vast bulk of what Justice Breyer and what respondents are concerned about.
Are courts going to be able to assess the state of mind of the infringer at the time of the infringer's conduct without getting into communications with the company's attorneys?
Yes, Justice Alito, and they did historically. And, I mean, I would point the court to a case like Consolidated Rubber in Judge Learnenhand's opinion. He said, look, you know, the patent was open to doubt for a period of time, and so no enhancement. But at some point, Here, the facts changed, and the infringer knew about them. It reasonably should have known the patent was valid. We start the enhancement running, and then we get some misconduct on the back end, like we had in this case. And so he says, I'm rolling it all in. This was more than negligent, and here's the enhancement I'm going to give.
So, you had the case where, at the time when the question of enhanced damages is decided, the judge can see that the defense was able to, with the help of good lawyers, was able to put on an objectively reasonable, although unsuccessful, defense. How are you going to be able to show that the infringer did not have that same information at the time of the conduct in question?
Well, I think in the typical — the intent cases are fairly easy because they're generally copying. I think in the typical recklessness case, the infringer will come in and say, here's the fulsome claim letter I sent you. It's actually got a claim chart. It maps on the infringement to the patent. I reached out to you. You never responded, and you continued to infringe. And I think at that point, then, the defendant has got to say, okay, I did something, but it doesn't have to be talking to a lawyer. I talked to my engineers. I looked at the specifications in the patent. You're limited to devices with four wheels, and I have three. I think there are lots of things that are commercially reasonable depending on the circumstances, and I honestly do think if you go back and look through the cases historically, that's what good judges and courts were doing for a very long time before the Federal Circuit essentially stripped discretion from them, and having taken the bar too low in underwater devices, overcompensated in Seagate. We think the bar ought to be high. We just don't think it ought to be arbitrarily high as it is now. I'd like to reserve the remaining time.
Thank you, counsel.